Dr. Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
the physics of how a soul cell works, and then hopefully, if I keep on talking enough, I'll talk about the banded economics of, you know, what could happen if you were smart enough. The basic idea of a soul cell is it's made out of silicon. So silicon's in the periodic table under carbon. So it has four valence electrons and a potential outer shell of eight. So it's got two, eight, and four electrons in its third shell. This is giving the traditional viewpoint of silicon as an atom. And the silicon is just not your normal silicon that you have. Say a lump of silicon. I could buy a lump of silicon and there'd be no particular crystal structure. I could dice up as a powder. It's got to be a crystal, and moreover, it's got to be a single crystal, or crystals. You can have crystal phases. Now, a crystal phase, essentially is a type of crystal, but it's the orientation of the crystal which is important. So your orientation of crystal can be defined as a three-digit number. I've forgotten what the actual term for it is, but 011 would be one crystal orientation, and 110, you get different crystal phase orientations. And you can see this in the sort of the older silicon cells, polycrystalline. You can see these crystalline areas. Now, much to surprise us, to get you a bit used to these crystalline phases, when you see galvanized iron, fresh galvanized iron, before the thick, milky zinc oxide layer has really built up, been quite thick, you'll see these patches of different regions of crystals. Particularly in the older solar cells, you'll see these polycrystalline layers. But what the major thing that a solar cell is made out of more nowadays is single crystal silicon. And how that's done is that I'm not sure quite well. I may be out of date on this, some of the aspects of it. You get a large vat of silicon, and you heat it up, such as silicon is liquid, and there's various processes to remove impurities from its liquid form. And then you can start with seed crystal and slowly draw the crystal up as this vat cools, and this tiny little crystal grows to an ingot. An ingot, typically, I don't know, a couple of feet wide, very long, multiple ton ingot drawn off. And this ingot, it's got this very silvery, shiny look. And in the center, each atom will be aligned as a single pure crystal. So each silicon atom, if I define a silicon atom at one area, that pattern of atoms will be carried forward to another area. So each atom is exactly the same. The atom structure is exactly the same. It's a single crystal of silicon. Now, this ingot is taken and it's sawed into very, very fine sheets. So it's the thickness, I think they're getting down to 100 micron, 200 micron. Just to give you an idea, a sheet of paper is roughly 50 microns across. So if you've got four sheets of paper, that's the thickness of your solid cell. Very, very small. Now, of course, that if you had that, that would just shatter. And what should we say? There's various animals jumping about the place. That would shatter. It's put on a substrate, a piece of glass, a process, but these very thin wafers are taken out, and this silicon is in generally something called N-type. Is that right? What's in general N-type? So it's got a few extra electrons in the conduction band. So we'll talk about bands in a bit more detail. So the silicon is got these large crystals. Now your silicon solar cell is really, the full name for it would be single crystal silicon. So if it's amorphous silicon, it's not going to have any of the properties necessary for a solar cell. Now, a periodic array of atoms will have a frequency associated with them. That is, if I get a stick, I don't know if you in overseas countries you've got corrugated iron. Australia's full of it. You just run your stick across the corrugation, you'll hear the frequency of corrugations. I can't think of overseas where you could feel this ripple. No, you know, in corrugated cardboard. So if you've got your corrugated cardboard, you've got the flat layer, then corrugations, and then another flat layer. So if you lift that top layer up and you can run your finger across it, you can feel that vibration. Now, if you said the crests of those vibrations are positive charges, what would happen is that if you have an electron, now this is where we have to part company with the old way of thinking. Electrons are not a single little grain of dust, little beetle going across the thing. It's actually a sort of like a gas, this crinkly gas, and each electron, despite due to the laws of physics, each next electron can't be like the other one, and so it's like if you have to keep on ordering electrons, you order the base one, and the next one is, I'd like to order another electron for my lattice. The next electron has two ripples in it, and the electron after that has three ripples in it, and you say, look, you ordered, look, can I have another single ripple electron? Because they're the nicest, they're the sweetest, they're low energy. And the laws of physics say, sorry, you can only order the next electron in the series. And so essentially, when you're populating your lattice with electrons, so these electrons are big things, they go from one end of the lattice to the other. They're very big things, electrons. I'm sorry, that's quantum mechanics for you. I won't try and explain that too much. So your electron is not smaller than your nucleus. It's actually much bigger than your nucleus. It's hard to get across. Your electron actually is the size of your crystal. It's called a molecular wave function. So the electron that I'm considering, I can mathematically describe an electron. My mathematical description involves all the atoms in my lattice. There you go. And for a metal, that's quite easy. You know, I push one electron in one area, but it really floods the entire metal crystal to go across. Okay, so we've got this process that each electron I put in has a different number of crinkles, and it's looking at here, there's large bodies of water. But it's like there's no frogs in it. It's interesting. So the frogs must know that water mustn't last, must be very short. They must also know what the weather is coming up, because if it's going to be days of rain, the frogs will go into the water. Okay, that aside, so I'm walking in the Australian bush at night. I can't tell you what the time it is. because I've got a analog watch. That'll be pretty late. Okay, so your electrons are coming in, and so each electron you add has an extra crinkle, and this means that that electron, which has an extra fold in it, each fold increases the curvature of the folds. That rate of curvature is corresponding to something a bit like speed or energy of the electron. So the more curvy it is, the higher energy it is. And so as you say, if you're collecting, say, notes or something, and each one's higher energy, if you store them, they'd form a chart, say, at the bottom of your fridge, right up to the top. The very top would be the most crinkly, at the highest energy. Now, that array of for each electron drawing a line across for its energy is called a band diagram. That is a diagram showing a band of energies, many, many different energies. And so as you go up, your electron goes in. If your lattice can't hold any more electrons, you'll have a potential band, which I could make, but for the electron, I could order an electron, but I can't store it. There's no sort of, there's only so much charge to hold so many electrons. So I can imagine more shapes, geometric shapes going up, but there won't be electrons in there, unless I can do something rather tricky. I can get a electron with, say, 50 crinkles in it, and I can crinkle it more with an electric field, you know, that is an electric field with crinkle built into it, which tends to change the shape of the electron and make it a bit more crinkly, and I can make that 50 electron, I can add 20 crinkles to it, and I can pop that, change the crinkliness of that electron, and so the electrons will be in the same position. It'll be more crinkly, and it's a measure of its crinkliness. I can reposition it. I can pull it out from position 50 and put it up at position, say, 70. There'll be no 69 or you know, set down to 50. There'll be nothing there, but I will have created a gap underneath and put it up the top. Now, although physically I'm storing on my fridge front space, I haven't actually moved the electron. I've just made it a bit more crinkly. Now, the ultimate electric field crinkler is a photon. That is a light wave. A light wave is oscillating electric field, and that oscillating electric field can interact and crinkle my electron. So that's an electron moving up a band diagram. So the electron moves up the band diagram, but the electron physically doesn't move. It just changes shape. What do you think is happening? And can I say, I've sat in there with 10 people teaching, creating the HSC exam, they're all 10 people are convinced that the electron physically moves when it absorbs a photon. It doesn't change shape, because how could it? Because it's only a tiny little dot. And they believe it physically moves. It jumps across the band gap. So, like, for goodness sake. So, look, what I'm saying is heresy, and you just wouldn't say that type of stuff in a meeting. So, for instance, just to give you an idea, say if you're out in the car park, and you saw the King, Elvis Presley. You say, thank you very much. I'm now leaving the building. He gets in his Cadillac and drives off with his jumpsuit and his hair waved back in his glasses. So I'm leaving the building. Mind you, don't tell anybody. And then you go inside, and everyone's there saying, the King is dead. He's dead. He died. Anyone, we're going to kill anyone who says he's alive. You go, nothing. Oh, nice day. It's that sort of insanity. Okay, so 10 teachers, HSC exam, correcting people, teaching people, they haven't got a clue. Okay, so your electrons are these big things that can crinkle and change shape and move up, and you can register like a league ladder where the electrons are on the energy graph. A graph of energy is a conceptual representation of the real world. Okay, so the concept of energy. There is no dimension in physical dimension in space which corresponds to energy. It's a mathematical representation. So when I move one electron from one position on the graph to another position, the electron itself is not moving. It is becoming more crinkly. So it's sort of like, I don't know. If I am working along, I open up the thing and say, blah, 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 you've been promoted to manager. You're up to the next pay packet. Okay, so what's happened in all the organizational charts, I am physically moved up the organizational chart. I'm physically moved up the chart of, and I learned a move like that. But it doesn't mean that I myself have physically moved. I'm still there. I've just changed. Yeah, how do I get it across to you guys? I don't know. So what is that Venn diagram? If the y-axis is the energy level and the lines are across, we haven't got a band gap yet. What is the x-axis? Well, the x-axis, firstly, it's a three-dimensional diagram, and we're only taking two-dimensional perspective of it. So this is going to really creep you out. The x-dimension, going across the page, is quantum number. That is, the electrons are, a particular electron has, for that area, I can have thousands of electrons with the same energy, but they achieve the same energy by a different combination of quantum numbers. It's really effective if say in a box, the electrons will have quantum number positionings. So the electrons will have a point value of of momentum. That is, they will have three coordinates of NNN, and each of those NN, oh, that's a bloody bat. Far out. Sorry, that nearly hit me in the head. Okay, sorry about that. So that momentum will be NH, 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 NX, H, NY, H, NZH. Okay, and so that will be a point. Electron is a point. Is a point particle in momentum space. However, it is a wave function in our real physical space. So if you look at momentum space, and if you can imagine a particular energy level will be a sphere in momentum space. Yes. So the energy is nx squared plus ny squared plus nz squared. It's your vector coordinate out in space. It's the length squared. It's momentum squared, px. So momentum is mv. Energy is mv m squared v squared divided by m to get your energy. There's a way of getting your energy. It's momentum squared. So the energy is not quantized. Let's get this right. The momentum is quantized. That has to be, because momentum is related to the number of folds. You can't have half a fold of an electron. Okay, so I hope I'm making sense here. Look, you get disgusted, okay? But then get a solid-state physics book, open page 1, read until you don't understand, stop. What do you do? Read it again. Push on point by point. Look, the solid-state physics book is correct. It has built your computer. That is the book that someone has picked up and said, I can do something with this. I can build a computer. So if you've got a computer in front of you, the route for you to understand your computer is via that solid-state physics book. End of story. So electrons are point particles. They have got a point in momentum space because they're quantized. However, they're spatially big. And so your Venn diagram here has got the x-axis is n, and y-axis is the quantum numbers there, and the z-axis, so the y-axis up is energy. Now you're saying, momentum is this three-dimensional space. How am I fixing it into one dimension? Well, essentially, there's sort of a few mathematical tricks which allow me to compress the dimensions down. And they're only approximations, and there's sort of things that go on to do it. So essentially, a point on that, the Venn diagram is not a two-dimensional diagram. So you're seeing a two-dimensional diagram of a Venn diagram, an energy Venn diagram. The energy Venn diagram is a three-dimensional space, at the minimum three-dimensional space, of energy, momentum, and quantum number. And we have rotated it such that the momentum is in to and out of the page, and the because the momentum is related quasi to the energy. The energy has got a momentum factor with it, modified by a lattice energy or telescope. So there's a certain amount of redundant information there, so I can get a lot from a two-dimensional slice of it. So, you know, God help us, we're trying to actually teach this to the kiddies, and people teaching will listen to you for a little while and just say nothing, quietly slip out of the room and teach what they've always taught, which unfortunately is technically wrong. Okay, let's keep on moving here. It means that you're allowed to have a point in energy space, but that energy quantum number momentum energy space is all one point, okay? And you're allowed to move that point from one point to another, but it physically does not move. The electron physically does not move anywhere. It just changes shape. Okay, that's an organizational chart that you have there. In essence, it is a graph as much as it is a chart. it represents things. Now, an individual electron on that chart is not stationary. Okay, it has a momentum in one particular direction. Now, so what is going on? Well, it's because the way that we have done the chart is that we can have positive and negative momentum, and that will be a parabola. If you took away all lattice effects, the only thing is that if I increase the momentum by so much, I square it, and that will give me the energy. It's like a parabola. So if I rotate this chart, so into the page is momentum. If I rotate the chart such that momentum is now across the page and energy is up, I will simply have a parabola. And what that means is that each point in there, rotating it back, is in fact two electrons, one travelling one direction and one travelling in the other direction. So each point in there is actually a little doublet of points, and that doublet of points is such that you have a stationary electron. So what happens is that if I have a lump of iron, a lump of whatever, a lump of copper, a lump of silicon, and say it's something that conducts, and I can tell you that at the end of the day, there is no electrons leaving that metal. The electrons are reflecting back and forth, and in effect, if I do the phase diagram, the counting, for each point I have in my phase diagram, it's actually two little points, one travelling left, one travelling right. And so it is not, which drives me insane, you can't put a field across a band diagram and get electrons to move from left to right in the band diagram. That is totally insane. That's just gone bananas. There's a slice version that you can actually do it and create a field, but it moves things up and down, and things actually don't move from left to right in the band diagram. There's the entire story of electrons you have a hole there. So initially, essentially because they don't know that each point in that bad diagram represents two two points. So if I hold a piece of paper and bend it up like a parabola, so it's got a base underneath it, and I hold it up and I look at it, so the lines are running across. At any point where I look there, if I continued through, I look for something on the other side. It's got the two momentums cancel out. Again, I say, I'm not... look, if I thought this is original, I'd publish a paper on it. But unfortunately, it's not. So, you know, for goodness sake, go... I think it was probably third year university. No, it's like, probably third year university. Honours, probably honours, something like that. So it's not too hard, for goodness sake. Oh, well, it's just that you could not have an argument with any of these people, because the job descriptions get there is that they can't be argued with. Okay, so the entire idea of a hole moving in your band diagram due to being filled from left to right is just complete heresy. If you have a hole in your diagram, so in your band diagram, there's an electron missing in there, that means that looking through there, you've got one electron moved from one direction. The electron underneath it is still unbalanced, and so it begins. There's a current associated with it. In fact, if I put an electron at an energy level on a band diagram, and it's up there in the conduction band, it's not moving. However, if I split that electron such that it's got, so each point represents two electrons effectively. If I split that such that the left has got a different momentum to the right, momentum, i.e., say you've got two people walking and one person walks faster one direction, that electron will move. That's the band diagram stuff, and you need to know that in silicon. And silicon is a material for which we have the band diagram plus a strong lattice effect. Why is the strong lattice effect? Because we build a strong lattice. A lattice is a regular array of atoms. Now, what this happens is, so if you imagine the electrons getting all large, the size of the crystal, and they get more crinkly as you go up the energy levels. Now, what happens is that as the frequency of the electrons, crinkles of the electrons, equals the frequency of the crystal, the electrons will start to hit the positive nuclei. They will actually get closer to the nuclei. They will start to actually approach silicon atoms more. So negative will start to move closer to a positive charge, and for that energy level of those electrons of that frequency, I will start to lower that energy. It'll be harder to ionize that electron. That electron will be, the lower the energy, the harder it is to remove the electron. That's what energy levels are. So it'll start to depress it, and it'll be, keep on going and keep on going until it's absolutely sweet on, and then it will miss the frequency. And so this, when it will suddenly go to the frequency, and then when it's off resonance, it will fly off, and the next one will suddenly increase in energy. So it'll be really sweet, and then I'll tweak it a little bit, and so it will be tweaked on with the frequency straight off, and then it will be tweaked off again. And this sudden change from attraction to repulsion will mean that the electrons, the next electron I add in will be at a much higher level. And this sudden change of frequency of the electron, so you have a spatial frequency of an electron. So an electron is a point in a momentum space, but in real space, it's got curvature, and that curvature is defined as a spatial frequency, and this frequency can resonate with the crystal, and so when it hits on resonance, it lowers its energy, and then it suddenly can no longer get close to the crystal, cores, and so the energy will be much easier to remove the electron. The electron will spend a lot less time close. This overlap will be less with the positive charge. I'm coughing here because I'm strangely, it has been raining like buggery here in Australia, but it's getting a bit dusty, and you can sort of tell what the weather's going to be like. It's going to be a rip snorting day tomorrow. I can hear it in that the frogs and stuff, they know it's going to be dry. I don't know how they do it, that they know it's going to be dry. You know, we've got our weather forecasting. I don't know how they know. So you can tell what the day is going to be next day, but it's by listening to the bush. So I don't know how they do it or what's going on. Okay. So that's our band gap, and I don't know quite, there's this, if you look at it, momentum space versus energy, the momentum are tiny little dots, because they're quantized. Yeah, quantized means it's a dot, it is a point, okay. An electron is a point particle in momentum space, is a wave particle in physical space. There you go. I think it's got a wave point particle duality, but not as some people would love it. It's actually not a duality in reality. It's a duality that we use point physics to describe the momentum space, and we use wave physics to describe it in physical space. Okay. Now, what I do is I have this parabola. Okay. Just checking what's going up here. And so I've got this parabola of momentum and energy, and it's going p squared for the energy. Now, what happens is it hits resonance, and what it does is it cuts this parabola bends over and flattens out, cuts and then jumps at the energy gaps and smooths out. And so what I do is I have this effect that I have these slices through this parabola, and as it slices over, that parabola's gradient goes from climbing up, and it flattens out. And so what I can do is I can reconstruct this. I've got this complicated shape, and I can reconstruct it such that I can move the positive rolling over, to say, to the right, with a negative rolling over to the left. I can cut it at the zero point and move it across so that it forms a lovely little hill. I can get my two halves. You're going to have to imagine that. So essentially, and then for the other top bits, I can actually, so the for the first, the bottom one, I move the negative side of the parabola, cut the parabola in half, move the negative side across such that the two cuts line up on a flat and create a hill. Right? So that's a hill. And then for the positive things, I can just move, for the ones above, I can just move the negative across to the positive and move it across. And that's the way that I can construct a band gap. Now, if you don't know that step, it's a bloody mystery. And it's one of those things that, oh geez, this very bright moonlight coming through there. So in your band diagram, if you are not, if they just skip telling you how the maths is done, you will remain forever ignorant. And I've tried to describe that as best as I can. But essentially, in this space, this momentum on the x-axis, energy on the vertical axis, just as coming across here, I'm going to be buggered when I get back. Gee whiz. I'm only at the... Oh, far out. Sorry, I was just looking around here because there's these glowing things close to the ground. Don't know what they are. Okay, I've never seen that before. These little glinty things. I don't know whether it's a piece of glass or something out in the bush. I've seen a few really funny phenomena walking at night. There's one time when I saw... it's true. Look, I was walking up a fire trail and looked down. I could see this green, eerie glow. I don't know what it was. There's nothing. There was no civilization there. Yeah, it was a hard to maneuver creek area. But there's just this. I can't quite describe it. It wasn't a green light reflecting on something. The actual. It's like this green glowing gas. I don't know what it was. I saw it there once. Okay. I wasn't drunk or anything like that. I was pretty sharp. I saw it there. It's obviously probably some phenomena to explain it. Okay, but hearing all that, let's talk about this. So I've got this parabola with this cuts in it. I can actually cut the parabola, move the shapes, move this parabola which has got these cuts in it such it looks like two surfaces. The bottom surface, which is the valence band and the top surface, which is the conduction band, and the three-dimensional space, that there is a gap between these, the top and bottom parabola, because it's got this resonance, lattice resonance, which is the energy band gap. So essentially, if I have a stuffed silicon crystal, the effect of the periodicity will be reduced, and that band gap will reduce. So to get a full-on band gap, which I can rely on, I need a single crystal. The smaller the crystal, the smaller the band gap. Then also so silicon's silicon's got a more localized charge than carbon. Carbon's got a greater, more sinusoidal charge. So this carbon's got a greater band gap as you go down. It's the charge density around the iron which determines the strength of the band gap. So the silicon atom is more shielded by the inner electrons around it. I don't know. Have I described that really well? I don't think so. No. Okay. So you've got this band gap. Now, looking at it here, I have the real poetry of what's going on is this momentum on the bottom axis and energy on the top axis. And what happens is that I have now basically a hill and a valley, and there's a gap between. So above the top of the hill, you're going up, is almost like a reflected upside down hill or a valley above it. And each of those on the surface of that there are positions for holes or positions for electrons. That there are organizational chart positions for electrons. The electrons physically don't move, they change shape. So I can physically change shape. Now, one of the things is that we have a few rules here. It's not like stakes and ladders and anything like that. You can only move vertically energy from a photon. So a photon coming in to a photon carries momentum. All right. So it carries two types of momentum. But importantly, so it carries a small bit of linear momentum, which is lambda on h, and then it carries another unit of momentum of plus minus h, depending on whether it's circularly left or right polarized, circularly polarized. So there's the momentum. Effectively, because the momentum, there's so many momentum values, the electrons can actually physically change shape. And when they change shape, they're limited to, you know, what they can access. They can't actually, can't actually, in this momentum shape, just pick up momentum. They can't, a photon hitting it, which is the wiggler factor. The wiggler can change its shape, but it can't push it. It can't get it to, it can change its shape, but in such a way that it does it. Now, that means that there's only one way that a photon can actually go in. It can only select a particular type of electron and change its shape from the bottom of its band diagram to the top. Can only change it, in that direction. When you are moving electrons in the band diagram, you're only allowed to move it vertically up or at a very slight angle up, and that's due to the laws of quantum mechanics. And that's due to the effect of the shape and dipole transition moments. that is the electron is acting like an antenna. Okay, well, that's how antennas work. Antennas pick up electromagnetic radiation and convert it to electron energy. So it's your silicon is acting like a antenna for this light frequency, and there's only precise wavelengths in which so each wavelength can access a different electron, but you've got many different options. Now, the great thing is that if I hit up an electron up to the top band, what would happen is that it would go up to the top band and immediately drop down again and re-emit your photon. Photon dust, photon waves. And in general, that would happen in a direct band gap. Now, this process would be absorbed, but we have something else happening. And what we do is we have the top momentum curve displaced from the bottom momentum curve. So it goes up to the top, and before it hangs around, before it comes down, it's up there, there's nothing immediately beneath it, and so a little bit of crystal vibration, a little bit of interaction means that it then collapses down to the bottom of its of this this top valley. The electron moves, it appears to move down, but all it does is it changes shape ever so subtly. And to change shape, it's got to exchange momentum and all this type of stuff. There's many. One thinks of the how it does it as vibration, and it has to be vibration. The electron loses a certain amount of energy. You put in so much energy, you kick it up, and then but then the electron will lose a certain amount of energy. So it's absorbing the light. Some of the energy is put into thermal energy, thermal vibration. This electron goes down, but that electron will now go down into a gutter, which if you look beneath it, the actual band beneath it is fully full, because your bottom band is fully full of electrons, the top band has got no electrons. This is something I haven't really explained about silicon. Silicon is just perfect because it's got really pure silicon, has just the right number of electrons to fill the bottom band, but not the top band, that bottom hill, but not the top valley. The top valley is vacant. So electrons can be fired up to the top valley, then they go down to the bottom valley, and at the bottom of that valley, it looks down, and it's got full electrons, and it says, bugger me, I guess I'm stuck. And so what happens is that light energy is now stored in the silicon as electrons. It's forbidden to recombine. And so you have essentially a whole electron pair. Okay, now this is an interesting aspect. A hole and electron pair can be localized. Yet I've told you that these things are really large. They're not the size of the lattice. Well, I doubt that anybody's going to be bloody well listening at this point in time. If you are, you're a superhero. And if you're in Ukraine, get yourself some vodka. If you're in Germany, schnapps. If you're in France, cognac. In America, Jack Daniels. In Britain, a gin and tonic. Italy, Yuzo. I really can't think of what, in any other country, anything else you want to do. But yeah, if you're a good Australian, just drink, don't drink beer, just drink some water, pure water. That's all you should be drinking if you've got to be nice, fit Australian. Okay, so we've got this thing is where the band gaps are moved. It's called an indirect band gap. That is, why they call it indirect? It just means that the electron, once pumped up, falls in the conduction band. The conduction band is shifted such that the electron is locked away. Energy gets locked away in the lattice. So, we want to, in general, we create an N-type semiconductor. So we, a P-type is holes with P is 3, P is 3, N is, you got extra stuff, N is like nitrogen or phosphorus, N for nitrogen, no, it's around that way. And so it's got a few extra electrons, and so we've got no, there's definitely no holes hanging around the place for it to recombine. Oh yeah, I was saying why it's there. You can localize an electron. Yeah, I can definitely localize the electron in a lattice if I wanted to. But in order to build up the Fourier picture of that electron at a particular point in time, I actually need a whole host of electron wave functions to build a localized electron. So just talking about a localized electron means that you are talking about a reconfiguration which doesn't correspond to the band diagram. So the band diagram corresponds to my description of the lattice with these large electrons. If I want to do something else and have, you know, localized electrons, and, you know, just generally localized into a micron, we're talking these crystal lattices centimeters across, I can't use my band diagram the way that I wanted to, because then I now call thing, I have a time dependent function. So one of the basic things is that a band diagram, there is no motion, there's no time dependence on it. If I wanted to build up a particle, I can definitely do that. I can build up a local, you do that for sure, but to do that you have to get a whole series of electron wave functions and add, you have to build a, it's got a time dependence. It will have, yeah, basically, if I've got a localized thing, it's moving around, it's got to be time dependent. I've got to build it up of a series, you know, a Fourier decomposition of a square wave, a bing, a clack. If I do a pick, if I do a scrunch on a tape, that's got a large frequency range. So if I hear on a tape, even though it may be made by a single frequency, because I've cut that frequency up, I've defined the time, the frequency varies. So you're allowed to do the two things, just that the connecting maths is different. And where do you do Fourier? Possibly second year physics, probably first year physics, quite honestly. It's all part of the Fourier story. And you need to know it, you need to study it. And if you don't study it, you can't understand it. You've just got to listen to it. I mean, that's just the basics of it. So you've got all this maths, and if you pretend to understand it without the maths, what you have achieved is that you've pretended you've understood it without the maths, that you're going to say potentially nonsensical things, which you will not be able to be capable of understanding why it's not sensible. I think that's really much the fairest thing. I don't think these people are bad. They're just they're just tuned, because they don't understand anything, they say understanding comes from intelligence peoples in university, and then they're very insulted to say that they say and behave in such ways that the intelligent people in university don't speak to them, because they want to keep a relationship with them. They want to be able to speak to the students. They want the students to come to them. And so there's this folly going on. It's a bit like the French court. You know, I think the king is absolutely mad, but I'm going to humour him by actually telling him that you've got the best menagerie and the best chateau, and oh gosh, you've got fantastic taste. And meanwhile, the country's going to rack and ruin, this type of stuff. Okay, so the important thing is that photoelectric effect inside silicon occurs inside N-type silicon, end of story. So your charge build-up, your charge build-up is through N-type silicon. You have a thin layer of P-type silicon out there to create a depletion layer and also a migration layer, a one-way diode for which the charge can cross and you get a voltage across it. So you get a diode voltage built across it. There. So you need P-type at one end, and you need, which is okay, and then you need the light to go through the other layer. Now, for the other layer, you need very thin wire mesh, because the electrons have to get onto that wire. So the holes, I think the holes go to the P-type and the electrons go to the wire type. So essentially what you're doing is that you are creating a material where electrons are trapped where they don't want to be. And the only way that they can get back down to the N-type, back to the... some of this is quite scary. Okay. So you see rocks there off the side, and they're not wombats. Okay. So that's the... So forget the depletion layer. The depletion layer, I don't know the number of people. It's just painful to have explained to me how you get electrons to cross the depletion layer. You get holes across the depletion layer and stuff like that. The depletion layer is a side story to what's actually happening in the bulk of silicon. So your solar cell, all the photoelectric effect happens in just purely in type silicon, and that diffuses across the depletion layer to create your battery. So in effect, that light hitting a silicon will cause it to have electron hole separation, and a voltage will appear across the diode. Essentially, you have a light sensitive diode, an NP diode, which has the phenomena of creating a driving voltage. It turns into a light-activated battery. as light goes up, the voltage increases. And I sort of wanted to think if the depletion layer increases as the voltage increases. I think that basically has to be it. And so your diode generates electricity. Now, the point here is that it is a battery. We come against our first thing is that to get your system working, the batteries are wired up in series. And the way it is that your voltage out, the way it is the voltage of your weakest battery. So if I have, say, 600 volts, I will possibly have about 400 solar cells end on end. I think it's 1.1 or more end on end arranged. So that's your solar panel. A single solar panel will produce around 600 volts, not much of an amp. But you put a whole series of these in parallel, and you'll produce something out of it. Now, the issue is that if you have one in your stack, if you have one underperforming cell, the whole lot will drop down. So essentially, if you want to ruin a solar cell system, you just be a pelican and have a good shit over some of the solar cells. Okay, that's an okay thing to do. But there is this thing about where you create that DC is drawn off and is modulated through digital electronics to be cut and pasted and flipped and inverted and at high speed to produce a 50 volt AC circuit, which just goes to the rest of the world. Now, of course, if you were perhaps smart, given that your electronics for your pool pump requires AC to convert it to DC to drive, you could just put DC, you could cut out a lot of the middleman here and get some energy. I think it would be interesting, and of course your DC is what should be stored in batteries. So you've got a whole series of things that you can look at. But essentially, for every, if you've got a bank of solar cells, you can manage the load. So if it's got very weak light, you don't ask for a lot of voltage, you ask for a reasonable amount of current. If it's producing a lot of things, you can actually change the effective load that you can see. So you can load manage your solar cells to get the maximum energy transfer from it. So you basically, if you've got some solar cells, you need a little computer there which will adjust how much energy is pulling out. So essentially, you can open circuit your solar cells with no current and get the maximum voltage, or you can drop the voltage. You can close the circuit and get maximum current, but the voltage will drop, and so your power from your solar cells is VI. So depending on what you do, you can select the resistance of your load. You can adjust the resistance of your load to maximize the formula VI. So there's a little computer program going through, and it works out what's going on, and it will adjust everything in real time, basically. And so you'll see these suspicious little bumps and stuff like that. As you see, computer program a bit lagging behind. It takes, as things goes behind the clouds, and sort of energy is stored in the circuit, and it's a fairly complicated thing to look at. But essentially, for each bank of solar cells you have, at a different angle, a different position, you need a separate. Oh, so that's a speed bump, a new speed bump that I put there. Gee, is that it really stands out at night? Sorry, a new speed bump. Oh God. Okay, sorry, I am doing this while walking at night. So say if I have a house and I have an area which can sustain so much area, the best option, the cheapest option, to tick all the boxes is to have a single converter inverter, I think it's like a single inverter, and a single bank. Then I necessarily step down if I have another bank at a different angle, which may mean I can add the two together, but I need a separate inverter. The inverter will not be able to find the ultimate PI, which fixes both set of solar cells. So you need an inverter for every bank, which is okay. Now let's look at some of the costs and benefits of this. The major thing is that essentially you could have one inverter, and that one inverter for panels at different directions would work ideally in a cloudy day, because your influx is pretty much the same. But the moment the sun comes out, it really, the amount of power on your solar cell massively increases. If you've got a normal house, and you probably would be, I mean, the ideal way, if I was building solar cells, our house is surrounded by trees, thank goodness, but it means that, you know, there's light patches off, and we've got two banks of solar cells, and they are just sort of muddling their way through, I think, a bank of six and a bank of seven solar cells. Can't be right. Four and eight or something like that. Can't believe it. Eight pointing okay. And what it means is that we get sort of a double hump, which is not sort of super fantastic. Now, the bottom line is that if you produce excess energy, the power companies pay you a pittance for it. They don't pay you the full amount that you're saving them, because they really don't want it. They would much prefer to be selling the electricity, and so they're out there to make a profit from you. So it's actually not that fantastic to get, you know, a great energy system. It's actually quite good having the two-level thing. Now, the economics of it, I think it, you know, I find this a bit interesting, I believe. Now, let's be brutally honest. What would be rather nice is a modular system, which would allow you to, say, have four inputs of just a moderate, say, I think our one's 12 kilowatts, something like that. Is that right? I just have to really, it can't be that much. But to have a system, so you've got the system of your ideal home with a system which can take so many kilowatts in. What would be nicer is to have a system which can actually broken up to four banks of solar cells, so you can actually just move them around at different angles, that a system which is cheaper, and basically on the one or two days of a year where it's absolutely going like the clappers, it's over voltage. It's got more voltage than it can handle with, but that's okay. So these systems, I do understand, can have too much voltage, too much power in it, and it can just easily do it by making it a dumb thing and saying, there's heaps of sunlight here. I think I'm only going to take my maximum voltage by actually putting in a higher resistance. And so the voltage goes up, and it peaks up, and it just takes the peak voltage. You can actually just essentially open, you know, have an open circuit. And just, so there's no, you're not going to blow anything up by putting too many volts into having a too powerful system going in into it. Essentially, Let's look at what's going on. I can have a narrow amount of houses, say a small percentage of houses, which are all set up, have the trees cut down, everything right, and they're one inverter. Sorry, this is a bit disturbing. I hope the water level hasn't increased for me coming here. It's sounding bloody dangerous. I hope I'm not stuck. This is going to make my night out here. I'm coming down a canyon, and just the water sounding pretty ferocious coming down here. Okay, so there's one economic model, which is the simplest economic model, and that is a single inverter and a single bank of cells, which are optimized, and in such a way that this is clearly the economic best way to do. Let us consider a house which is going to take four panels. None of them are particularly optimized, that house will compete with a perfectly optimized house on a cloudy day, because there's no directions. The setup really doesn't matter, and it will provide a small moderate increase. Say it's producing 300 watts. If you say double the capacity, as idealized, it will produce 600 watts. And its point at which it cuts in to run the background house equipment and catch you off grid changes dramatically. You are paying so much energy for it. Then the economics is that you are if you've got a longer period of the day, which you're not, there's no real point of getting over voltage in terms of you haven't invested in the batteries. You're not getting any money. You may as well have a large number of cells which are operating inefficiently, but for a much longer period of the day on many more days of the year. So comparative inefficiency is just eye-watering on a bright sunny day, but it's not that bad on your average cloudy day or morning day, or if you happen to be I'm just going to have to walk on here very carefully. Okay, walking across here. Okay, walking up here. Okay, I just have to watch this. This feels really strange walking across here. It's a very nerve-wracking thing. I don't know why it is. It's a fairly large causeway. It's just a little bit of water over the top of it. And I'm through. Oh, I don't know why that's such a nerve-wracking thing. So that was a causeway at the bottom of a canyon. Now I'm away. So I'm going to breathe a little bit coming up here. So, look, there is this economic model. So what are we doing? We're buying excess. People with excess money can buy, excess money, can buy up solar cells, cut a ridiculously small amount out of their bills, but it's still an irritating amount. And, of course, the bills are going up with carbon taxes. And what you do is you've got a system where your house has additional solar cells. Now, the big question here is, what is the actual sunk cost? Is your solar cells fully depreciated? Or is there a scrap value in the aluminium fittings and a value in the thermal integrity of your house? Can we actually go through the small change values for it? And is there technology markets out there that you can buy up your cells and then sell lower cost cells to other groups. Now, There are these huge suburbs going up all over Sydney without a single solar cell to speak for itself. And this is whole suburbs. Like, within years, or 2 years, they will go from a greenfield site and just build a whole suburb. This is pretty amazing stuff as you go through, and you can see not a single solar cell involved. And I think it's worth an inquiry what's going on. So for that, so in terms of public affairs, national affairs, there's things that you can do on national level, but there is got to be a turning point where it is possible for those people of the pool who are buying solar cells. So it's about, 20% of the country up around here, we've got solar cells on it, but in certain areas there are none. I'm just really thinking aloud, is if you can have the economics, the stupid economics of where it's cost a break even to have solar cells and for its effect. So especially one of the things where you can actually over engineer and have too many solar cells for your requirements. So in good areas, I'm breathing as I'm just going up this fairly steep canyon, just fairly slowly. So there are technologies coming online. So this is battery storage or distributed energy storage. At what point can you build additional solar capacity in a dumb way, which cuts off the very high peak production of it? And it'll be interesting to know at what level there is. Now, that being said, industries, households are suckers to pay energy companies. And essentially, it's too much time effort per individual to actually optimise your own energy. But throughout Australia, they're getting energy consulting firms in and basically hooking up everything to monitors and computers, getting it centrally controlled, and actually just cutting the energy bills. So there's these things are happening. This is like really basically every factory now has been turned into a smart energy use factory. Of course, this is sending people absolutely insane, the coal lobby, because the actual energy demand of Australia is falling year upon year. Yet our coal production is increasing. And of course, as one knows, the coal lobby is all powerful. Of course, what we really should do is Australia should suddenly unilaterally say, we're not exporting coal, we'd become a basket case economy, the World Bank would help us, we'd have to do massive restructuring, it would send the world into an energy frenzy. These people will be rubbing their hands, the United States and Poland and Russia, people who have coal supplies. They'd massively invest. I don't know. It wouldn't do anything, but it would send a shock price wave, which would kick us to habit. At the moment, the US is pumping out heaps and heaps of oil and coal, and the price wave is not going. The price information isn't going going ahead. So understanding that, my sort of question is, can you be absolutely stupid with your solar cells, if you want to be, and just nibble away at these low percentage things which cost you an awful lot? That's one aspect. The other aspect is there's water-borne solar cells. It seems to have a very obvious choice in the startup companies, which so this is a dam or a flat area, and the idea is that you cover the dam with solar cells, and which is on floating pontoons. Now, the sheer economics of solar cells, so I've been told, means that this is an attractive but very stupid thing to do, because solar cells are so cheap that, and the land base access is so clean, that it's really cheap just to select a site and just build a land-based base area. But that being said, the other aspect of energy is the high voltage DC to allow continental energy power use. Now, again, the this would potentially allow a very high energy production in Northern Australia via perhaps solar cells. I think the solar cell, by its definition, is low energy density, so its main advantage is providing low energy density supplements near a population centre. It's not something for like a huge field of solar cells to produce energy in competition with a power station. It is probably going to be best, although Australia has no nuclear power stations, the best proposal I can think of is building a large internationally operated power station in Australia, in Northern Australia, to supply the energy needs of Indonesia. So Indonesia is the big archipelago. So there are these, besides China and India, there are these other, and you've got the United States Japan, there are these other large, very large population centres sitting around the world. One is Brazil and the other is Indonesia. And it's said of Indonesia that Indonesia is the land of great, has great potential and always will, in terms of there's no clear path forward with the amount of fragmentation and religious politics happening in Indonesia. But that being said, it would seem very logical for Australia, which is we just don't have earthquakes here, we're tectonically stable, no volcanoes, nothing, to actually supply energy up to Indonesia, which is the opposite. It's got the world's biggest volcanoes and it's tectonically very active. And has very sensitive wildlife. So if you have a look at it, China is funding hydroelectric dams in Indonesia, which is destroying orangutan habitat and a whole series of things. It's China's putting a huge amount of money into energy infrastructure into Indonesia, which is coal, nuclear, and hydroelectric. But these have a huge impact, whereas sort of a limited scale, it could be possible to think broadly and build a system in Australia. I would actually specify baseload nuclear. I think basically all nuclear. Once you've got the investment in nuclear, that's just my overall view. I'm not standing for election. And with these things, they can be safely dismissed right away. The only other energy project I would have is an iron fence set up. This is basically just a wire fence with iron spray guns on them, and you mount them into the gale force winds, which are always blowing near the Mawson station in Antarctica. So Australia has stations in Antarctica, which no other country would ever dream of building because the weather is just so dreadful at them. This is essentially a DC Van de Graaff generator, which can produce fairly nice quantities of energy. And obviously Antarctica is a long way away, but there would be ways to use the energy up there. I'm going to have to stop now as I catch my breath. And I hope this has been some worthwhile insight here. I'll just put it up on the internet. I really don't expect people to actually soldier through all the winding routes. So this is a discussion of silicon solar cells. Some of the economic wondering is about, is it possible in a non-cooperative economic environment to find a mad but desperate uptake of solar, to go that next step. Is it possible again to build a geopolitically sensible energy solution, connecting two countries up, getting the correct pieces of the puzzle together? And is it possible that there are other low impact energy sources which we can tap and use in imaginative, innovative ways that we haven't thought through? Thanks a lot for listening. Sorry for breathing so hard. I'm just now at the top of the canyon. Good night.
Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.